Are we there? Okay. Now, we left off at Judges chapter 7 and verse 8. And just to summarize very quickly, Gideon has blown the trumpet and sent messengers to a number of the tribes of Israel to rally them together for war against the Midianites, who had been oppressing their land for 7 years. And how he managed to blow this trumpet without being noticed by the Midianites, we don't know, except that perhaps the Midianites were not very close by to hear it. However, they did learn of such a person as Gideon somehow, because we read in the verses that are immediately before us that in the camp of the Midianites there was a terror already of this man Gideon. Whether it was by revelation from this dream that we read of, and the inspired interpretation of it, or whether news had got back through Midianite intelligence that there was a man named Gideon calling forth the Israelites to war, we don't know, but somehow the fear of Gideon had already preceded him, as we'll find immediately. But once these people rallied to battle to Gideon, the Lord surprised him, I guess, by saying, well, this is too many people. There were 32,000. He said, if I save them by this great number, then they're going to think they did it by their own power. Even though at their largest, they were still outnumbered 4-1 by the Midianites. But the Lord said that's the ratio is not great enough. The differential is not enough. The deck is still not stacked enough against them for God to surely get the glory out of this battle. So he told them, all who were afraid, to go away and go home again, and they did. Though they later rejoined the battle in verse 23 after it was quite visible that God was with the Israelites, those who had been afraid apparently took courage and joined in the battle. After those fearful ones had gone away, which were 22,000 of them, there were 10,000 left, and God said that's still too many, and so he had further eliminations through bringing them down to the water to drink. And those that laid on their bellies, on their knees, to drink and sticking their face in the water in a prone position, seemed to be eliminated, probably because of their inattentiveness and their non-warlike mentality. They were too at ease. They were they didn't seem to sense a state of emergency. They weren't like fighting men on the field of battle. But those who just gathered water in the palm of their hand and lapped it with their tongues, and thereby remaining able to keep their eye all around them and not with their face in the water, those were the men that God said he's going to save by, and it turned out there were only 300 of them. And so God had eliminated almost 32,000 people in favor of 300 up against 135,000 Midianites. And so you can see why Gideon is commended for his faith in Hebrews chapter 11, because he didn't back down. Now, you might think that when 32,000 were there, there might be even some reason to fear, but at least there's a lot of encouragement to see a large army. But when it was down to 300, you can see that he had nothing but faith to fall back on, faith in God's promise. Of course, he had good reasons to believe God's promise by this time, because an angel had first announced that it would be through him that God would deliver, and a supernatural sign had been shown by the fire coming out of a rock to consume a gift that Gideon had prepared there, and the miraculous disappearance of the messenger, the angel. Further, there had been further confirmation by the fleece incident. Two separate times, he had put out a fleece and sought certain results if confirmation was to come for his call, and certainly we find that God honored that, and so he had every reason to believe that God was on his side. But still, in a day where idolatry was rampant, and even in his own father's house, Baal was worshipped, still, to have faith in Jehovah for such a great thing as this would seem to be asking a lot. But we find that there's one other encouragement that is given to him, and that is in the verses that immediately follow. He's now left with 300 men ready to go to battle. But still, he needed some further encouragement. And this we see that though he was a courageous man, he still needed people to... he still needed incidents, circumstances to one way or another confirm that God was really going to work this out. And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get thee down to the host, meaning of Midian, for I have delivered it into thine hand. But if thou fear to go down, go thou with Phurah, thy servant, down to the host. Now, God is going to show him something that should allay every fear he had. Interestingly, he had just said to the soldiers, any of you who are afraid, go home. And then God said, if you're afraid, I've got one more thing to reassure you. And he went down there. In other words, he was still afraid. God said, if you're still afraid, then go down to the host and I'll show you something. And since he did go down there, it would seem like maybe there still was a little bit of fear. And he did need further bolstering of his faith and of his confidence. So he did go down. And it says, and thou shalt hear what they say, and afterwards shall thy hands be strengthened to go down unto the host. The expression strengthened hands, or the hands being strengthened, is a common biblical figure of speech. It's a Hebrew figure of speech, rightly translated in the King James. And it doesn't mean what we would think by strengthening the hands. It literally means to be encouraged. Even in the New Testament, though it's basically a Hebrew and Old Testament expression, even in the New Testament we have at least one example of it in Hebrews chapter 12, where it says, wherefore strengthen the hands that hang down and the feeble knees. And basically the exhortation is be encouraged. And you will find that as we go through the Bible, this expression comes again and again, and it always means to be encouraged, to strengthen the hands. So God is saying you will be encouraged after you hear what they're talking about down there. So then he went down with Phurah, his servant, into the outside of the armed men that were in the host. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number, as the sand by the sea for multitude. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow, and said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it, that it fell, and overturned it, and the tent lay along, or lay flat. And his fellow answered and said, this is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all his host. Now, you know the inspiration of God was in this situation. I mean, simply because who would have ever gotten that meaning out of a dream like that in the first place? And secondly, for the people to be afraid of Gideon when they must have known that they certainly outnumbered him. And for them to know also that God had given Midian into Gideon and his people's hand, this would seem to be a divine revelation that the man who interpreted the dream had. So both of these men had the working of God's Spirit upon them to convey this message. And whether that message was mainly given by God to instill fear in the Midianites or to instill faith in Gideon, who was overhearing it, we couldn't say which it had more of an effect on. But we do find that there is already a terror in the camp of Midian, at least at this point, as a result of this dream, if not before, about Gideon and what he's about to do. Now, the man, one of the Midianite soldiers, woke from his dream and told his dream just at the moment that Gideon and his servant were there. Obviously, a matter that God ordained to happen. And the dream was that a loaf of barley bread came down and smote a tent and knocked it down. Now, how would anyone get the interpretation that was gotten out of that dream? Well, I have a feeling that there was already a lot of unrest among the Midianites about Gideon, and there was news that he had gathered thousands of people together, which was true. They probably hadn't heard from the latest intelligence that he'd also dismissed thousands of people. But they'd heard that people were gathering from all over the area to war, and that they had a strong leader finally for the first time in many years. And so there was some unrest anyway. And then this tent of Midian getting smashed would be highly significant. Of course, in the dream, the tent got bowled over, and it was in the tents of Midian, so obviously it would speak of the camp of Midian being defeated. And the fact that it was a barley loaf, barley bread was the poorer man's bread. It was fed to animals, really. Barley was fed more to animals, and the poor ate it, sort of like dog food today. You know, some of the poor elderly who can't afford real food sometimes have been known to go and buy dog food, which is a horrible thing to realize, but most people ate wheat bread, and barley was really, when you're scraping the bottom of the barrel and you had nothing else to eat, you'd eat that. And it spoke probably of the impoverished Israelites. The fact that they were poor, that they were not impressive, and yet you would hardly expect a loaf of bread falling out of a tent to smash it flat. And as unlikely as that seemed, so it seemed unlikely that Gideon and his men would defeat the Midianites, and yet it happened in the dream. And probably because there was already this discussion about Gideon in the camp of Midian, that the people interpreted the dream along that way. And so, at any rate, God intervened to make that dream occur and be told and be interpreted in that way, just at the right time and place for Gideon and his servant Phurah to hear and to be encouraged. So it says in verse 15, "And it was so, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof, that he worshipped and returned to the host of Israel and said, Arise, the Lord has delivered into your hand the host of Midian. And he divided the 300 men into three companies. And he put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and lamps within the pitchers." Now, notice that swords are not among their equipment. They have trumpets, and they have, in the other hand, a torch with a pitcher over it, an opaque and breakable pitcher. Excuse me. I'm not sure exactly how that apparatus was designed. I'm not sure how you would carry in one hand a torch with a pitcher on it without... I don't know exactly how you'd maneuver that, but they had some way they did that so that they had a pitcher over the torch to conceal the light until the appropriate time. And then, of course, at the appropriate time, the pitcher would be broken easily and the light would shine out suddenly. And that was the idea. And it says everyone had one of these, and they were divided into three camps. And he said to them, "Look on me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outside of the camp, it shall be that as I do, so shall ye do. When I blow with the trumpet, I and all that are with me, then blow ye the trumpets also on every side of all the camp, and say, The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." So Gideon and the 100 men that were with him came unto the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch. And they had but newly set the new guard, the watch. It was the changing of the guard, and there was a new guard that just came to watch. The middle watch, there were actually four watches. They were 3 hours long each, at least in Israel. I don't know the Midianites, whether they had the same policy, but the Israelites had four watches through the night. From 6 to 9 in the evening was the first watch. From 9 to midnight was the second. From midnight to 3 in the morning was the third. And from 3 in the morning to sunrise or 6 o'clock was the fourth watch. Either the second or the third under that system could be the middle watch. I think it was probably what the Jews would call the fourth or the third watch, about midnight, or maybe about 3 in the morning. It could have been midnight. That would have been this beginning of the third watch. At any rate, it was sometime in the middle of the night. It was not the first watch, which went all the way up till 9, so it was certainly later than 9 at night when this took place. It was quite dark outside. And it says, the three companies blew the trumpets. Well, I guess I must have, I did something, I missed something here. The end of verse 19. And they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. And the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers and held the lamps in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, The sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And they stood, every man in his place, round about the camp, and all the host ran and cried and fled. Now, Gideon's strategy was this. He'd put 100 men, apparently, in where he was, and then 100 men on each side. And all they had were torches and trumpets, and yet 300 trumpets blowing at the same time and voices shouting, especially if they weren't shouting exactly in unison, so they were kind of... staggered time-wise from each other, would sound like an incalculable number of people. And with all these torches blazing in the midnight sky, it would be blinding, for one thing. You know, obviously when the trumpets blew, the Midianites would all jump out of bed and look and see in that direction. All they'd see would be all these torches, hundreds of them. They couldn't tell exactly how many, and they certainly couldn't tell how far back the armies went. So they just assumed that these thousands of people of which they'd heard were upon them, and here it was the middle of the night. They were all in their pajamas and didn't have their armor or their swords, and they realized that they were at a disadvantage, so they were thrown into a panic. And this is, of course, that's to give a natural explanation of it. Besides that was the fact that God, purposely set them into even a greater panic. There are other occasions in the scripture like this where God intervened in the battles of the Israelites and caused the enemies just to be in a panic so that the enemy killed each other. Probably in the camp of Midian, while they were all jumping out of their sleeping bags and pulling their pants on and stuff and hopping around on one leg and things like that trying to get ready to fight, there was such a commotion, and it would appear that the enemy was right in the camp, that people just started grabbing their swords and hacking away. It was so dark anyway, because the only light was these torches out there, and it was dark. I just think they were thrown into a panic that every man for himself, you know, anyone who comes close to me, I don't know if it's a friend or foe, but I'm protecting myself, and started swinging their swords. And as such, of course, none of Gideon's men were actually in the camp yet, so they were not getting hit with the swords, but all the Midianites were killing each other. And that's what it says. And it says in verse 22, and the 300 blew their trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host, and the host fled to Bethshitta in Zererath, and to the border of Abel-Meholah, unto Tabeth. I'm sure you're familiar with all those places. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali, and out of Asher, and out of Manasseh, and pursued after the Midianites. Now, these who gathered themselves are from the same tribes, notably, that Gideon had first summoned to join him. So they are probably the same ones that had been sent home because of fear. But now they say, hey, you know, we want a piece of this action too. It's obvious that he was right, that God is with him, and this is really going our way. So they all joined together and followed the leaders there. And Gideon sent messengers throughout Mount Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites, and take before them the waters unto Bethbara, which is, by the way, one of the places John the Baptist later was baptized in, Bethabara. In John chapter 1, I think it mentions it. And Jordan, then all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. And they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and they slew Oreb upon the rock Oreb, and Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb. Now, it shouldn't be thought that it happened to be coincidental that they slew the guy at a place that happened to bear his name. Of course, the way to see that is that they named the press and the wine press and the rock after the men after they were slain there. The rock and the wine press were remembered thereafter as being the place where these men were slain, and therefore their names were affixed to them. Oreb means raven, and Zeb means wolf, and these are very typical names for Arab military leaders. They adopt names of fearful animals, not fearful, but fearsome animals. And so raven and wolf were their names, and they were slain by the Ephraimites. Now, the Ephraimites were not among those who were originally called to the battle, and so the next chapter tells us that the people of Ephraim, they were so jealous. They make trouble later, too. They just they're always looking for a fight, is what it really gets down to. They're always looking for a bone to pick with their brothers to fight. And the men of Ephraim were angry because Gideon hadn't called them in the first place. Now, this is related in the opening verses of chapter 8, though probably it didn't happen at this point. It probably happened after the battle was all over. But since the men of Ephraim and their part in the battle is mentioned at the end of verse 7, the writer simply puts the appendix or the sequel to what happened between Gideon and the Ephraimites at the end of the battle at this point, though he later goes on to describe further parts of the battle. But since the Ephraimites are in the limelight here at the end of chapter 7, we find that later in verse 1 of chapter 8, and the men of Ephraim said unto him, why hast thou served us thus, that thou calledest not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide with him sharply. They scolded him, and they were upset with him. But a soft answer turns away wrath, and at this point Gideon was wise to resort to that rather than getting indignant. And he said unto them, what have I done now in comparison to you? Is not the glean of grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison of you? Then their anger was abated toward him. That means they cooled down when he said that. Now, what did he say? What he said was, listen, you guys have done greater exploits in this battle than I've done. You got the princes. I mean, here, all I've done is chase down ordinary soldiers, but you guys are the ones who got the prize. I mean, you guys are really the winners. You guys are really the champs in this one. You know, it's like he was really, in a sense, flattering them. And he called them down that way. When he said, is not the gleaning of grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? What he's referring to, of course, all the people in those days were very familiar with vineyards. I mean, that was one of the main ways that people made a living, was raising grapes in those days. And the vintage would, of course, be the best grapes that are harvested and used for making wine. The gleaning refers to the stragglers that are, you know, after the harvesters have been through and taken all the grapes that they intend to take, then the poor could go through afterwards and glean. That would mean take whatever's left, whatever's fallen on the ground, any straggler grapes that didn't have to get picked. In other words, the refuse. And what he's saying is not the gleaning of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Now, Abiezer was the Gideon's own people who were involved in the opening part of the battle. Whereas what he's saying is, you guys, even the, I don't know what to say, even the gleaning of Ephraim, which is the people who are complaining, is greater than what we've done. That is to say, the least that you've done is better than the greatest we've done. Now, that's probably overstating the case. I'm sure it is. But it was a matter of saying, hey, you guys are more important than you think. You guys did more. You guys really won the battle for us. You know, you got the princes, and I haven't done anything compared to what you did. And that's what he's essentially saying. That he didn't answer why he didn't call them in the first place. Probably he didn't want people that were as divisive as them with him. But anyway, he managed to cool them down by flattering them and saying, well, you know, the best that we did is not even as good as the least that you've done. Our vintage isn't as great as your gleanings, is what he's saying. Okay, well, Gideon came to Jordan and passed over. Now, this is still in the thick of battle. It's not over yet. He and the 300 men that were with him, and they were faint, yet pursuing. And he said unto the men of Succoth, which was a city on the east side of Jordan, he pursued the Midianites past the Jordan. He wasn't willing just to drive them out of the land. He was going to pick them all off. And so they fled over across the Jordan, as many as could, to get away, although the Ephraimites knocked off a lot of them as they were trying to get across. But what were left, Gideon and his 300 men were chasing. Now, they came to this east Jordan city of Succoth, and this was a Jewish city. And so Gideon needed refreshment for him and his men, and he expected that his own brothers would welcome his men and show hospitality and give them something to eat so that they could finish off the battle. And he said, he came to Succoth and said, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand that we should give bread unto thine army? In other words, you haven't caught them yet. And are we going to take the risk of helping you out and maybe incur the wrath of Zeba and Zalmunna against us if you happen to lose? They weren't willing to believe that their own countrymen were going to win. Well, whether they thought that Gideon had a chance or not, this was obviously an act of treason. When their own soldiers in the middle of a war come to them and all they ask for is refreshment, and they say, well, I'm not sure I'm on your side. I don't know if I want to throw in my lot with you or not, because if you happen to lose, I could get in trouble too. Well, that's obviously the risk you take when you're in battle. You stand with your own side, and you trust that whether you win or lose, that you're going to share in either the victory or the punishment that comes on your side. But they were not loyal to their own countrymen here. And so Gideon made a threat. In verse 7, he said, therefore, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with thorns out of the wilderness and with briars. This is an ancient Middle Eastern form of punishment and torture, which is known to have been practiced with thorns in Palestine. Are very, very long, short spikes and thorns. And what, of course, Jesus had a crown of them put on his head. It is known that some of the tribes and nations in that area used to punish people and torture them in this way, that they would place these thorns against their naked bodies and then press them between boards or something like that, to, obviously to puncture their bodies. Now, that was not a form of execution. It was just torture. They wouldn't die, usually, but they'd kind of wish they had. And it's really a painful thing to do, and it's not the kind of thing that Jesus would probably do if he were in Gideon's place. But Gideon is an Old Testament character and didn't know about Jesus. And he's just a warrior. And warriors sometimes do bloody, horrible things that we as Christians wouldn't necessarily approve of. And by the way, it doesn't indicate that God inspired Gideon to bring this kind of a harsh penalty upon them, though they certainly were worthy of some punishment for their treason against him. he might have been a little overly severe. Verse 8 says, "And when he went up thence to Penuel, another Jewish city on the eastern side of Jordan, and he sought the same thing from them, he spake to them likewise, and the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. And he spoke also unto the men of Penuel, saying, When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." So he's going to punish them too, because they wouldn't help his army as they're pursuing the enemy. Now Zeb and Zalmunna were in Karkar, and their hosts with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of the hosts of the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword. So 120,000 out of 135,000 were dead. Only 15,000 were left. Still, 300 guys against 15,000, still going to take a miracle to win this one, but they don't seem to be having any trouble, because God is obviously intervening. "And Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in the tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbehah, and smote the host, and the host was, for the host was secure." Probably what it means is the host felt like they were safe. Gideon was detained, remember, dealing with the people of Succoth and Penuel, asking for food. He was hoping to take a break, at least take a quick meal and pursue, so that the distance between Gideon and the flying Midianites had widened. And the Midianites may have felt like the pursuit was over, and they were gone back now to their cities, and they probably had taken off their weapons and were thinking themselves secure. They thought the battle was over and they were safe in their own country and pursuit was ended. But they were quite wrong, because after Gideon dealt with the men of Succoth and Penuel, he was going to continue. So they found them in secure, meaning, of course, that they felt like they were secure, and that probably means that they were not ready for continued fighting. They must have taken off their weapons and been soaking their feet and stuff like that. And it says, "And when Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them, and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host." So they targeted, of course, the two kings, and then they caught them, and then they wiped out all of their soldiers. "And Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle before the sun was up, and he caught a young man of the men of Succoth, and inquired of him, and he described unto him the princes of Succoth, the elders thereof, even 77 men. As that calculates, 70. "And he came unto the men of Succoth and said, Behold, Zeb and Zalmunna, with whom you did upbraid me, saying, Are the hands of Zalmunna and Zeba now in thine hand? And we should give bread unto thy men that are weary." In other words, he taunted them. He threw their words back in their face, and he showed them that, sure enough, they were in their hands. "And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth." He punished them. "And he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city." Now, Penuel probably was a smaller city, and he just slew all the men in it, even though they were fellow Jews, but he was punishing them for their treason. As far as Succoth, he only punished the 77 leaders, or the princes or elders of the city. The rest escaped punishment. "Then said he unto Zeb and Zalmunna, What manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor?" Now, we don't know what he's referring to here, as far as there's no precedent to it. There's no there's nothing earlier in the story that talks about them slaying men at Tabor. As it turns out, these two kings had encountered Gideon's own family and his own brothers and had slain them. And apparently somehow Gideon had gotten wind of it. In the midst of the battle, someone must have brought a report that there was a slaughter at his own home area,
And now he wanted to inquire exactly to find out whether his brothers were dead or not. And he said, what kind of men did you slay there at Mount Tabor, or at Tabor? And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. In other words, they were of noble and royal demeanor, and they were well born, and they looked like you. And he said, they were my brothers, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if you had saved them alive, I would not slay you. Now, see, according to the law of Moses, if a man was murdered, it would be up to his brother to avenge his blood and to slay the murderers. So Gideon, though he was inclined to be merciful to these kings, and he would have otherwise saved them alive, yet because they had slain his brothers in cold blood, he was in the position under the law of an avenger of blood. He, as the brother, was to avenge their death. He said, if you hadn't killed them, I'd save you alive, but I can't now. I've got to kill you. That's my duty. And so he said to Jether, his oldest son, up and slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared because he was yet a youth. How old a youth is, we don't know. Probably in his teens, most likely. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, rise thou and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and slew Zeba and Zalmunna, and took away the ornaments which were on their camels' necks. In asking his son to do this, probably this was a means of seeking to elevate the status of his son, because ordinarily an executioner in a case like this would have to be of comparable rank to the persons he was killing. If royalty was put to death, or if men of high rank were put to death, usually the executioner had to be someone of equal rank or comparable rank. That was just sort of unwritten code of ethics, that you don't have a private slay a general of the other side. That was just not kosher.
So in asking his son to slay these two kings, in essence he was elevating his son to the rank equal to those kings. And we find that later Gideon's sons, all of them, were treated well. They never became kings, but they did. They were treated well, and sort of like royalty in Israel after this battle was over. So he did want to give his son some exalted position. This was his firstborn son, and though he was firstborn, he was still quite young, and I guess he just didn't have the guts to do it, and I'm not sure I would either, you know. You're standing there with these two royal persons in front of you, and you're given a sword and say, here, cut their heads off, it'd be a little rough. And the guys could see, the kings could see, that the young man was not likely to do a clean job of it. I mean, he's the kind of guy who's not sure he wants to do it, and he might kind of pull back and might kind of wound you and cut your head half off and you'll be still alive, and that's not what you want when you're going to be executed. So they said, Gideon, why don't you do it? According to, what did they say? For as a man is, so is his strength. There's, we need a man who's got the strength of a man to do it. I mean, we don't want to get the job half done. If we're going to die, let's do it all the way, and let's do it quick. So they asked Gideon to kill them, and so he did. And that, of course, was the end of the battle. Verse 22, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Gideon understood, of course, that right from the beginning of the Jewish history, from the Exodus on, that there was a special relationship between the children of Israel and God, that God would be their king and they would be his kingdom. And he understood that there was a good reason that they had never in their long history up to this point had a king. Neither Moses nor Joshua nor any of the previous judges had been king. They had only been under God, men who took orders from God and basically were God's spokespersons and arbitrated disputes from God's law. But very clearly, they didn't have anyone who was a sovereign in their country like other nations had. God was their sovereign, and no man could usurp that position rightly. And so Gideon seemed to realize that. And that's to his credit. You know, here he is, he'd be flush with victory, you know, and people come say, make us, king. He would be the temptation would be for pride to get the better of him. I mean, after all, it's quite an exploit that these people were in bondage for 7 years, and now all of a sudden the bondage is thrown off because Gideon had the guts to stand up with 300 guys and go out and do the whole job. And, of course, he would be feeling a little like a hero coming home. And when the people come out and say, oh, be our king, you can imagine the temptation to say, yeah, I guess I probably should be. But he had his wits about him. He said, no, that's not the way our country is. We don't have a king except God. The Lord shall reign over you, neither me nor my son. We won't reign over you. He was mistaken because one of his sons, Abimelech, did reign over them by usurping power wrongly. However, probably not over the whole nation. He made himself a king, but probably only essentially one city submitted to him, Shechem, as we'll see in the next chapter. Well, Gideon said unto them, I would desire a request of you. Now, I've got you eating out of my hands. There is one request I could make, a small thing, that you would give me every man the earrings of his prey. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. That is, the dead Midianites, being Ishmaelites, wore gold earrings. In fact, they wore a lot of different things. Their camels even had ornaments on them, as we see in verse 21. But there's a lot of gold there to be taken, a lot of spoils of battle. He said, all I ask for is the gold earrings. Well, when you got 135 times 2 gold earrings, I mean 135,000 times 2 gold earrings, that's quite a lot of gold. Now, it does say they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. Now, that's a strange statement because we're told, of course, earlier, they're Midianites. And Midianites were not the same thing as Ishmaelites. Ishmael was the son of Abraham by Hagar. Midian was the son of Abraham by another woman altogether, so that there was not really that close a relationship between Ishmael and Midian. They were like, what would you say, half-brothers, I guess. And, of course, you wouldn't expect them to be identified with each other as the same kind of people. And for that reason, some people have criticized the story of Joseph being sold into slavery because the story in Genesis tells that there was a group of Midianites to which Joseph's brothers sold him. And yet in other passages in Genesis, it says they were Ishmaelites that he was sold to. And some have seen a contradiction there because they say, well, make up your mind, whether they're Midianites or Ishmaelites. Well, interestingly, here we see the Midianites are Ishmaelites. So there must have been some mixing of the two families, so that the tribal distinctions of the Midianites and the Ishmaelites were blended. So that this is very clearly not a contradiction, but an explanation of a point that we wouldn't have known otherwise, that they are Ishmaelites, though they were Midianites. And so it's quite it solves what some have thought was a contradiction, when sometimes it says that Joseph was sold to Midianites, other times it said he was sold to Ishmaelites. Well, both are true, because the Midianites were Ishmaelites. Somehow there had been a mixing of the two tribes at an unrecorded time in previous history. And they answered, we will willingly give them, that is the earrings. And they spread a garment and did cast every man the earrings of his prey. And the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. Now, I don't know how much a shekel is, to tell you the truth. Some of you probably have in your Bibles, if you have something like an open Bible or something, you might have some charts in the back that say how much a shekel is. I didn't bother to look it up because it's, to me, it's not relevant to the main thought, but it's, I'm sure, a great quantity of gold. Yes, do you have it, Jack?
43 pounds.
A shekel is 43 pounds.
This is about 43 pounds.
Oh, the total number is 43 pounds. Okay, so you got 43 pounds of gold. I don't want to even calculate how much that'd be worth today. An ounce of gold is, you know, obviously in the hundreds. It's been as high as 500 and sometimes recently and down as low as a couple hundred. But obviously we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, to say the least, worth of gold that he was given. So at least he was not of the poorest family of Manasseh after this, as he was when he began the job. And the weight, was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the ornaments and collars and purple raiment that was on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were about the camels' necks. Now, these apparently were gold also. So he not only had those earrings, but he had a lot of other things that they gave him as well. Bonus for, performance beyond the call of duty. And Gideon made an ephod thereof, and he put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither, whoring after it, which thing became a snare to Gideon and to his house. One gets the impression that he made an idol with this gold. However, it doesn't say an idol, it says an ephod. And if you recall, an ephod was a garment. It was a piece of priest's clothing. In the tabernacle, the Aaronic priest wore an ephod, which was a tunic that went from the shoulder down to about the knees or maybe the mid-thigh. And it was mainly cloth. But apparently he made himself a solid gold ephod, as it would appear. And it says the people of Israel went whoring after it. Now, Gideon didn't want to be the king. He knew that was out of the question. But apparently he wanted to be a priest. Perhaps because, apart from the judges, from time to time, the most powerful political figures in Israel's governmental structure were the priests. They were the men of highest rank. And so, though he didn't have the audacity to claim to be king, yet he seems to have wanted to make himself a priest or have the dignity of a priest, so he made himself an ephod, which was a priest's garment. And when it says the people went whoring after it, this is the kind of thing that is said about them going after other gods and other idols, but that may not be what is meant here. It might mean that rather than going to the regular priesthood of Aaron's family, which was at Shiloh at that time, they went to Gideon, and they accepted him as their priest instead of the family that God had ordained as priests. And that was, in a sense, a whoring after not another god necessarily, but breaking from the prescribed manner of worship that God had given. It says the thing became a snare to Gideon and to his family. To be specific, we don't know in what sense that was a snare to him. Obviously, it seemed to stumble him. It led him into sin. It led others into sin. It may be that they even worshipped this ephod. It's hard to say. We just don't have much there. But we know that something he did was wrong. He did something wrong later in his life. Again, the heroes of the Bible, we're told not only they're good things they do, but they're bad things. And it does seem like the Israelites were so prone to idolatry. And maybe we shouldn't limit it to that race. Probably humanity is prone to idolatry. We have more refined and westernized forms than they did. And we don't actually carve idols around here, but we do idolize people and things. Rock and roll stars, movie stars, money, athletic stars, things like that. I mean, there is idolatry, definitely, in our society. And it does seem to be human nature, and it's certainly seen graphically and vividly in the history of Israel how rapidly person's hearts move into an idolatrous mode. And even things that are good can be made idols. For instance, we know that when Hezekiah became the king in 2 Kings, he had to take the brass serpent that Moses had made in the wilderness in the book of Numbers. And Moses had made this brass serpent by the command of God as a means of healing people who had been bitten by snakes. And apparently by then, by the days of Hezekiah, the thing had become not only a relic, but an idol. And it actually says that Hezekiah had to destroy the brass snake in his day because people had gone worshiping it. And that's a shame, but I can see that that's sort of human nature. Even when God ordains something really good, frequently people will make something bad out of it. They'll just attach to it an idolatrous worship. I don't have the reference to that. Oh, here it is. It's in 2 Kings 18:4. Speaking of Hezekiah, it says, he removed the high places and broke the images and cut down the groves, and he brake in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, for unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it. And that means they worshipped it. And he called it Nehushtan, which really means a piece of brass. Now, sometimes people have to be reminded, but that's all that something is. It's just a piece of brass. It's not a god. But people will take something that is no god intrinsically and make it a god to themselves. It's so desperate people are to worship something. Man, unlike the animals, is a worshiping creature. And those who say that religion is some kind of a man-made phenomenon and that there's no such thing as deity or whatever, have no way of explaining the fact that universally throughout history and every culture in the whole world, man is prone to worship and prone to believe in something beyond himself. Whether he's an animist and he believes that the trees and the rocks have spirits, or whether he's a polytheist and believes that there's millions of gods, a pantheon of gods, or whether he's monotheistic as we are or as the Muslims are, yet people believe and worship certain things beyond themselves. And the sad thing is, worship of God is not as attractive to some. Worship of a true God is not as attractive to some as worship of something of their own making. Because God makes demands. God makes moral demands. And moral demands require a certain amount of dedication to keep and to meet. So people don't want to make moral change in their lives and sometimes will fashion a God after their own image, which is, of course, the origin of every religion except Judaism and Christianity. And we need to remember, we as Christians probably don't have too much trouble with it, but people need to remember that anything other than God is just a piece of brass. It's just an object that has no divine powers. And we might say, well, anyone would know that, but obviously not everyone does. Some people mistakenly think that there is something in a God fashioned after their own image. In Isaiah, the prophet mocks idolaters among Israel. And he points out that this gold ephod, which is not beyond them to do, they did that sometime, that kind of thing many times. We don't know, but it became a snare. And Gideon made an ephod, it says, I already read that verse. Verse 28, thus was Midian subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted up their heads no more. And the country was in quietness 40 years in the days of Gideon. And Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, of course, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. And Gideon had 70 sons of his own body begotten, for he had many wives, that 70 sons with many wives. Of course, he couldn't have that many with one wife. And his concubine that was in Shechem, she also bare him a son whose name he called Abimelech. The reason he's mentioned separately is because his story is quite unique and comes up in the next chapter. He had 70 legitimate sons from wives that he had married. Then had a concubine, which was basically, a concubine didn't have the status of a wife, but had the status of a slave girl with whom the master would sometimes sleep and sometimes foster children, or would gender children by a concubine, as we know from other Bible stories. So he had this, what would be really an illegitimate son by a concubine, and 70, legal sons, we could say. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age, and he was buried in the sepulcher of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. And it came to pass, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel turned again and went a-whoring after Baalim and made Baal-berith their god. Baal-berith means Lord of the Covenant. Berith means covenant, and Baal means Lord, but it doesn't mean Jehovah of the Covenant. It's Baal. It says, so they're entering into covenant with Baal when they already had covenant with God. It's like if a woman would marry another man while she's still married to her original husband. It's an abomination. And the children of Israel remembered not the Lord their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side. Neither showed they kindness unto the house of Jerubbaal, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had shown to Israel. Now it says they didn't show goodness to the house of Gideon. This actually is expanded on in the next chapter, on what did happen to the house of Gideon. After he died, what happened to his family? And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, which is Gideon, went to Shechem unto his mother's brethren and communed with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, speak, I pray you, in the ears of all the men of Shechem, whether is better for you, either that all the sons of Jerubbaal, which are 70 persons, reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. Now, he's essentially saying, someone's going to reign over you. That was not a fair assumption. He said, either my 70 brothers or my 70 half-brothers or whatever are going to reign over you, or I will. What do you want? Well, that isn't really the two choices that... I mean, there was another choice. The other choice was that none of them might reign over him. Gideon had said, neither I nor my son shall reign over you. But here this man was an opportunist, and he realized that these men of Shechem would favor him over the other sons of Gideon because he was from Shechem, or his mother was the daughter of one of the men of Shechem. So he had some kind of tribal connection there. And so he said, well, remember, I'm your bone and your flesh. I mean, I'm related to you guys, and these other sons of Gideon aren't. So he got this one city to come to his aid. The men of Shechem thought that he had a good idea. And his mother's brethren spake of him in the ears of all the men of Shechem all these words, and their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berith, wherewith Abimelech hired vain and light persons which followed him. And he went unto his father's house at Ophrah and slew his brethren, the sons of Jerubbaal, being 70 persons upon one stone, except for one, notwithstanding. Yet Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. So Abimelech got 70 pieces of silver from the treasury of Baal-berith. The people had gone back to worshiping this Baal. And the people of Shechem are the ones who financed this thing. And with this money, he hired some assassins. Now, these assassins were vain and light persons, obviously. They were worthless sorts who would kill for probably a shekel apiece. To kill 70 men, he probably needed 70 executioners. To overpower them, at least. And so they probably got a shekel apiece for their dirty work. And he slew all of his brothers, except for the youngest who got away. And it says, and all the men of Shechem gathered together in all the house of Millo, and went and made Abimelech king in the plain of the pillar that it was in Shechem. Now Shechem happens to lie between two important mountains. Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And you might remember that those are the mountains upon which the children of Israel stood in the days of Joshua and pronounced blessings and cursings. The people from, I don't remember which was which off the top of my head. Was it on Ebal they pronounced the blessing, and from Gerizim they pronounced the cursing? And Shechem lay in the valley just between these two mountains. And Shechem is where these men were who made Abimelech king. Now, really, Abimelech never really had power over the whole nation, probably. He probably just had very limited jurisdiction over these few guys and maybe some neighboring cities that were brought under his power. But the escaped brother, Jotham, went and stood in the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted up his voice and cried and said unto them, hearken unto me, ye men of Shechem, that God may hearken to you. And he made this speech very quickly, and then he ran away because he realized that he would be as good as dead if he remained exposed to his brother's bloodthirsty schemes. So he gave this story in verse 8 and following. This, we might call it a parable, but not rightly so. It's not a parable. It's a fable. And the difference between a parable and a fable is that a parable is taken from a true-to-life situation. Like a sower sowing seeds, or fishermen gathering fish in nets, or a person putting leaven in a lump of dough, or a man leasing out his vineyard to tenants. Parables are always based on true-to-life situations. Whereas fables, like Aesop's fables, for instance, attribute to animals and to plants personalities, and they speak and talk and things like that, and that's not true-to-life, obviously. In either case, a parable and a fable both have the same purpose, and that is to illustrate some profound philosophical or spiritual truth. In this case, we have the oldest known fable in literature, Jotham's fable of the trees. It is, most scholars would agree, not only the oldest, but the best of all fables as far as its profoundness. And this young son of Gideon was a pretty sharp guy, because this is a very profound fable for him to come up with so quickly. I mean, he's just in flight for his life, and he happens to think of this tremendous illustration of what the people are doing. And so he called their attention, of course, at great personal risk, and he uttered this fable. Verse 8, the trees went forth on a time to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, reign thou over us. But the olive tree said unto them, should I leave my fatness, wherewith by me they honor God and man, and go to be promoted over the trees? And the trees said to the fig tree, come thou and reign over us. But the fig tree said unto them, should I forsake my sweetness and my good fruit, and go to be promoted over the trees? Then said the trees unto the vine, come thou and reign over us. And the vine said unto them, should I leave my wine, which cheereth God and man, and go and be promoted over the trees? Then said all the trees unto the bramble, which was a thorn bush, come thou and reign over us. And the bramble said unto the trees, if in truth ye anoint me king over you, then come and put your trust in my shadow. And if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Then he gives an interpretation. Now, therefore, if you have done truly and sincerely, and that ye have made Abimelech the king, and if ye have dealt with my father Jerubbaal and his house, and have done unto him according to the deserving of his hands, for my father fought for you, and adventured his life far, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian, and ye are risen up against my father's house this day, and have slain his sons 70 persons upon one stone, and have made Abimelech the son of his maidservant king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother, if ye then have dealt truly and sincerely with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice ye in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer, where he dwelt there for fear of Abimelech his brother. Now, let's talk about this fable. What is basically the message of the fable? In the fable, a number of trees are approached by the other trees to be made king over them. Well, the first thing to realize about this fable is it's an absolutely ridiculous situation. Not only in that the trees are talking. I mean, more ridiculous things than that could be conceived. But the more ridiculous aspect is that they're looking for a king. Now, what in the world would trees do with a king? Trees don't move. They stand in one place. They have no need to take commands from anyone. What could a king of the trees do? And that's just the point. Israel didn't need a king. And that's what Jotham was saying. Gideon was smart enough to turn down their offer of being king. Any man who's worthy of the office would be wise enough to turn it down, knowing that because God was their king, they didn't need a human king. And so the first thing about the parable or the fable is it's absolutely ridiculous, and intentionally so, that the trees are looking for a king. The most worthless job in the world would be the king of the trees. And that's what he's saying, essentially being king of Israel would be also, since they already had God as their king, why should they step down? It's ridiculous to seek another. Now, the ones that were asked were, first of all, the olive tree, which produced for the Jews mainly oil. Olive oil was used as a main staple in all baking, and of course in the temple a great deal, and oil just had a lot of purposes. They even used it as medicine. They poured it into open wounds and things. They didn't have anything else. They anointed their skin with it. Oil is sort of an all-purpose valuable item around the house, a real staple that every home needed, and it came from the olives. And so they asked the olive tree first, and then they asked the fig tree, and the figs were the favorite fruit of the Jews. The sweetest of all fruit, it was thought, was the fig. And it was, of course, fig trees were very common in Israel, and the fig tree is used as illustrations in some of the prophets and even in the New Testament, because it was a familiar thing. When Jesus said he cursed a fig tree, he told a parable about a fig tree that wasn't producing anything, and it was given 3.5 years, but it didn't produce anything. It was dug up. He also, of course, said, learn a lesson from the fig tree. Fig trees were very common in Israel. A very popular fruit in Israel is the fig. And it turned down their offer. We'll talk about why it turned it down in a moment. Then they asked the vine. Now, they were really getting desperate to ask the vine, because the vine isn't technically even a tree. Although in the scriptures, the vine is treated like a tree. Sometimes it's called the vine tree in the Bible. And while it's not what we would call a tree, yet the Jews thought of it as yet another kind of tree. However, a tree was considered majestic by its height. For instance, the greatest of trees were the cedars of Lebanon, according to the Jewish thought. And, of course, the highness and the extension of the boughs, the distance that it could extend, had to do with its value and its splendor. But when you're going to a vine, you're really stepping down from even the other trees that were asked. It's like they're getting desperate. The olive tree won't take the job. The fig tree won't take the job. Well, let's try the vine. That's really a low kind of a bush more than a tree, but no one else wants the job. And the vine turns it down too. And then, of course, they come to the bramble. They're absolutely desperate. And they come to the bramble, and the bramble takes the offer. Now, before we talk about what the bramble said, consider what the message of that part of the fable is. Essentially, every one of the trees and the vine that were asked to be king refused because it would require leaving what they were already doing. And what they already were doing had value. But what they were being asked to do would have no value. Why should I stop bringing olive oil to people, which is so valuable to people? Why should I stop producing figs, which everyone rejoices in? Why should I stop producing grapes, which cheers God and man? Why should I give up a reasonable, profitable way of life in order to do something that is absolutely ridiculous, like be a king of the trees, and that produces no good? And so what he's essentially saying is any tree that was worth anything, that had any value in itself or any function, would turn down the job. And the implication is that in Israel, any man who was worthy, who was productive, who had anything to offer to society, would turn down the job of being king of Israel, seeing that he's already got something profitable he can do. Why do that which is not needed? And of course, this is obviously a slur on Abimelech, saying that anyone who really had any value to society wouldn't want to be the king. Just like these trees that had value didn't want to be king. But the bramble wanted it. Why? Because it didn't have anything better to do. It didn't produce anything of value. It was just a weed. And so when the trees came to it, of course, it didn't have to leave any other occupation to take the job. It was the best offer it had yet. And it said, okay, if you want to make me king, here's a couple of options. First of all, come and trust under my shadow. Well, can you imagine trees trying to trust under the shadow of a thorn bush? I mean, it's absolutely absurd. And this is a picture, of course, of how the Israelites were foolishly trying to trust under the authority and the protection of a guy like Abimelech, which was as impossible for him to be a ruler and provide a protection and order and law when he was such a lawless and bloody individual. It's absolutely impossible for a nation to trust under the rulership of a person like that, just like it'd be impossible for trees to come under the shadow of a thorn bush. And he said, but if not, which is, of course, what would have to happen because they couldn't come under his shadow, then let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now, the bramble, the thorn bush, doesn't have much that it can be valuable for. It can't do much. It doesn't produce grapes or figs or olives. But it can do one thing. You can use it for starting fires. In the book of Proverbs, a fool's laughter is compared with the crackling of thorns under a pot. That is a pot that's set on a group of thorns that are on fire. The only value of thorns is to start a fire. And he said, well, the only thing the thorn bush can do to you is start a fire. But that's not going to help the trees much, because fire is no friend to trees. And fire will come forth from the bramble and consume even the big trees. Even the cedars of Lebanon, a little worthless thing like a bramble, can destroy mighty trees. Or as James chapter 3 says, behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And so what he is saying is this. No one who is worth anything would take the job of king over Israel. It's a ridiculous position to offer because Israel doesn't need a king. And anyone of worth would not be interested in the job. Therefore, the man who wants this job, namely Abimelech, is as worthless among men as a bramble is among trees, and as incapable of providing any protection or any kind of a lawful society and rulership as a bramble would be of trying to protect trees under its shade. And therefore, it can be concluded the only service the bramble will provide will be to ignite a fire that will destroy the trees. And he says, as he finishes up his talk, at the end of verse 20, he says, but if not, well, verse 19 says, if ye then have dealt truly and sincerely with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice ye in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. Just like, you know, like the bramble said, come and trust under my shadow if possible. But if that's impossible, which it is, if not, verse 20 says, let fire come out of Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. In other words, Abimelech is going to set the city on fire, and the fire is going to come back upon his head too. Now, at this point, Abimelech and the people of Shechem were loyal to each other. It was the men of Shechem who had made him the king. But it says, interestingly, in verse 22, when Abimelech had reigned 3 years over Israel, and probably over only a part of Israel is intended here, then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. Now, we're going to read how this unfolded, but basically a summary of what we're about to read is this, that God put hostility, and it actually says an evil spirit between Abimelech and the people of Shechem. That's an interesting thing. First of all, in that it says God sent an evil spirit, that trips a lot of people up, because it seems like the evil spirits are on the devil's side, not God's side, so why does he send them? And people ask that question not only here, but in a number of other Old Testament passages where it says God sent an evil spirit, or it says an evil spirit from God came upon Saul, or in 1 Kings 22, when it says that God put a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets of Ahab. God does dispatch evil spirits. Now, they are not his willing servants, but the Bible teaches fairly clearly that God is sovereign, and therefore even evil spirits, and even Satan himself, as the book of Job shows, can do nothing against man without God's permission. And while they don't desire to fulfill the purposes of God particularly, the only desire they have is to rob and to kill and to destroy, yet they can't even do that without God releasing them to do it. And therefore, as we see in the book of Job, and we also see in 1 Kings 22, the evil spirits and Satan himself have to come actually and present themselves before God and ask for permission to do their dirty work. And God, as we know, can, as often as he wants to, say no, and then they can't do a thing. But if it happens to fulfill his purpose in any sense, to release them to do what they want to do, then he gives permission. As in the case of Job, he allowed Job to be tested by permitting Satan to get him. But if God hadn't permitted it, Satan could have done nothing. What did Satan say? You put a hedge about him. I can't come close to him. And he was asking, would you please remove the hedge so I can hurt him? Well, obviously, if it wouldn't serve any good purpose for Satan to hurt Job, God would have never removed the hedge. Just because Satan asked doesn't mean God is obliged to go along with it. What we learn here is that God is in full control of our circumstances, both good and bad. And that there are perhaps, I should say, every day, many times when the devil or his evil spirits seek occasion against us. No doubt they'd seek our lives. I have no doubt that there are many times the forces of evil have sought to slay us and would seek to totally destroy us and pervert us and bring all manner of pressures against us beyond that which we're able to bear. But the Bible says God is faithful, who will not permit you to be tempted beyond that which you're able to endure. And so God shields us from a great number of things that the devil or his demons would propose against us. But when something does get through to us, when we really are tempted, when there is a trial, when there is an affliction, a sickness, or anything like that, we have to assume that this could never have come without God's permission, because God has a hedge about us otherwise. And it means that if God has given permission, there must be a purpose in it. That doesn't mean we should just accept it without seeking to change it, because maybe God has sent something to us to teach us to make war. You know, maybe he has allowed the devil to come through a bit so that we'll learn the skills of spiritual warfare to fight against it. On the other hand, there may be other lessons to be learned through it. But the point is that we can receive all circumstances as from the hand of God. And even when an evil spirit afflicts a man, it is because God has permitted it, or else it couldn't have done so. It can't do anything without his permission. So when it says God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, I believe what happened is similar to what happened in 1 Kings 22. An evil spirit came to God and said, I want to go and just stir up a lot of trouble down there. And it didn't want to do it for God's sake, but just because the demons love to make trouble and love to hurt people and love to divide relationships and just cause havoc. And God, seeing that that would fulfill the purpose that he had against Abimelech and Shechem, said, go ahead. And so God sent the evil spirit. And it was not an evil spirit that possessed anyone in particular. It was just a spirit of animosity and hostility and enmity that developed. And I, to tell you the truth, I believe that I have been in situations where such a spirit was operating. One case is very striking that I can recall where we started a community in Albany, Oregon once. It was just a household with about 12 people in it, and we were hoping it would grow, and we were hoping it would become something like what we have here. This was years ago, in 1978. And it only lasted 2 months before we had to disband it. But what happened is, within about a month of our establishing it, there began to be this strange enmity that seemed to develop between parties. And we never could figure out why. You know, someone would say, well, he said that. And then we get them all together and say, no, I didn't say that. I said this. And they said, no, I heard this. And the thing is, it's like there's this strange thing happening. I can't describe it because it was eerie. It wasn't, it's not just I could tell you the facts and you'd fully understand what happened, because I don't fully understand what happened. But I remember this situation. We were all close friends. But as time developed, there was a clear spiritual attack against us. It was a clear test. We later found out, and without beyond any shadow of doubt, because we got a confession from this person later, that there was a witch who was casting a spell against us. Now, I don't believe that we need to fear the spells of witches. I believe that if we are aware that such a thing is happening, we can do spiritual warfare against it and well overcome them. We have nothing to fear from them. But we didn't know that, and we neglected spiritual warfare. We didn't even suspect there was demonic intervention at all at first. And things developed to a point where I actually had to call a house meeting with everyone and say, what in the world is going on here? Everyone's at each other's throats. I can't understand this. I mean, we're all friends. No one's really done anything to really offend anyone else too badly. What's going on? And so they'd say, well, he said that and she said that and all this stuff. And finally, I said a few things that were meant to be conciliatory. And then they repeated back to me some things that I had said at that just a moment earlier. And they repeated them back in a totally different spirit than I said. And I said, that's not what I said or meant. And they said, well, that's how I heard it, you know. And I said, now, what's going on here? And one of the sisters spoke up. And she said, you know, I think maybe there's a demonic thing going on here. I think maybe you're saying things meaning something, and by the time it enters our ears, it's been all twisted around in the way we interpret it and understand it. And I said, no, we can't blame the devil for this. This is just flesh. Well, it turns out she was right. It was the devil. And we found out just the day after we disbanded the community, we found out because we got... Well, I can't go into the long... It's an interesting, very interesting story, but we found out about this particular girl who was professing to be a Christian and was coming to our meetings, and as it turned out, she had designs on me personally. I was single at the time, and she was interested in me, and she was casting some spells our direction. I don't know what the nature of them were. We later learned... She later repented and became a Christian, and she confessed this to us. But anyway, it was definitely a spirit of enmity of some kind. I don't know that it was a particular demonic personality or just a spiritual dynamic that came against us. And you know, I have to say the Lord allowed it probably to test us in some way, and we didn't pass. But I know what it's like when people who are friends can all of a sudden just, you know, just, I don't know, feel this animosity, and there's not a rational reason for it. At least there wasn't in that case. So we never found one good reason that anyone disliked anyone else. It was just, you know, it was just strange. It was really strange. And anyway, we see here a something like that coming between these former friends. No good reason. Just God wanted to put division between these particular people, the people of Shechem and Abimelech. And so he sent an evil spirit between them to create dissension between them. And it says that the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. And verse 24 says that the cruelty done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood be laid upon Abimelech, their brother, which slew them. and upon the men of Shechem, which aided him in the killing of his brethren. So God wanted to punish both Abimelech and the men who were his accomplices. So he used his accomplices to punish him and him to punish them. As it turned out, fire went out from Abimelech to consume them, and fire came out from them to consume him, as it turned out. Here's how it happened. Verse 25. And the men of Shechem sent liers in wait for him in the top of the mountains. That is, there were snipers that they set in the mountain passes, hoping to shoot him when he goes through. And they robbed all that came along the way by them, and it was told to Abimelech. Now, they got a little too greedy. If they hadn't robbed the other travelers, Abimelech might have fallen into their trap. But see, what happened is they were waiting for Abimelech, and while they were waiting for him, other travelers came through, so they plundered them and robbed them, and then news got back that there's guys like that in the mountains, and so Abimelech didn't go through there, and they didn't get their prey. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brethren and went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. Now, we don't know anything about this Gaal except what we have right here in this chapter. There's nothing else said of him or of his father Ebed, but apparently he was not a Jew. He apparently was a Shechemite of the old Canaanite tribe that lived in that city before the Jews took it over. And the reason I say that is because later on he's advocating that the people ought to overthrow Abimelech and set up one of the old kings of Canaan, the old Shechemite kings, which were Canaanite kings. And so he must have been of the Canaanite tribe himself. And we know that the city had a Canaanite population, at least partially Canaanite. And so the men of Shechem liked this guy. He was one of their countrymen. He was not a Jew. He was one of the old Canaanite guys, apparently. And it says, and they went out into the fields and gathered their vineyards and trod the grapes and made merry. And they went into the house of their God and did eat and drink and cursed Abimelech. Now, they all got drunk. They went out and gathered their grapes and trod them and had a big party with the wine. And when they got drunk, their tongues got loose and they started cursing Abimelech, which is kind of dangerous to do. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is not he the son of Jerubbaal and Zebul, his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for why should we serve him? Now, Hamor, the father of Shechem, was the one who was slain. Shechem and Hamor and their men were slain by Jacob's two sons, Levi and Simeon. You remember that story, how Shechem had raped or seduced the daughter of Jacob, and her two brothers, Simeon and Levi, went in and after deceiving the men and getting them to circumcise themselves so they were still sore, they went in and wiped out the whole city. And Hamor and Shechem were both killed at that time. But it would seem that some descendants of Hamor, an earlier Canaanite king, that some of the descendants were surviving, and this man, Gaal, was advocating setting those guys up as the king and not serving this foreigner, this Jew, Abimelech. And would to God, he said while he was still drunk, in verse 29, and would to God this people were under my hand, then would I remove Abimelech. And he said to Abimelech, increase thine army and come out. He must have sent a message to Abimelech saying, come on out and fight against me. He was probably still drunk at the time. And when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal. Now Zebul, we know, is Abimelech's officer. It says so in verse 28. So here he's the chief officer under Abimelech. And he heard of this commotion. And he heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed. His anger was kindled. And he sent messengers to Abimelech privately saying, behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brethren become to Shechem. And behold, they fortify the city against you. Now therefore, up by night, thou and the people that is with thee, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be that in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, thou shalt rise early and set upon the city, and behold, when he and his people see, or that is with him, come out against thee, then mayest thou do to them as thou find occasion. And Abimelech rose up, and all the people that were with him by night, and they laid wait against Shechem in the four companies. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entering of the gate of the city. And Abimelech rose up, and the people that were with him from lying in wait. And when Gaal saw the people, he said unto Zebul, behold, there come down from the top of the mountains And Zebul said unto him, Thou seest the shadow of the mountains as if they were men. In other words, Gaal was unsuspecting. He says to Zebul, Do you see any men coming down there in the mountains? And Zebul says, No, I think it's just the way the shadow is moving because the sun's coming up. And then says, Gaal spake again and said, See, there come people down by the middle of the land. And another company come along by the plain of Meninim. Then said Zebul unto him, Where is now thy mouth, wherewith thou saidest, Who is Abimelech, that we should serve him? Is not this the people that thou hast despised? Go out, I pray now, and fight with them. And Gaal went out before the men of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many were overthrown and wounded, even to the entering of the gate. And Abimelech dwelt at Arumah, and Zebul thrust out Gaal and his brethren, and that they should not dwell in Shechem. And it came to pass, on the morrow, that the people went out into the field, and they told Abimelech. And he told the people, and divided them into three companies, and laid wait in the field, and looked, and behold, the people were come forth out of the city, and he rose up against them and smote them. Even though the city of Shechem had expelled Gaal and his brethren in a show of loyalty to Abimelech, Abimelech just decided he was going to not show any mercy on them because of their previous insurrection. And even though they appeared to have repented of that, he was going to wipe them out. And Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood in the entering of the gate of the city. Now, this was not a rational thing to do. Again, the most recent action of the city was an act of loyalty to him. And yet he comes against it. Why? Because there was an evil spirit from the Lord to stir him up to do these irrational things and act hostily toward those who were actually his friends. But he wasn't acting in his right mind, you see. And so he came and he slew them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day. And he took the city and slew the people that was therein and beat down the city and sowed it with salt. There's some difference of opinion as to what it means that he sowed it with salt. Probably it means that he put salt out in the fields to hinder the growth of crops and to punish the city in that way. Others have felt that salt simply, because it is a preservative and that it kind of symbolizes perpetuity and something continuing the same without decay. And some feel like he sowed it with salt in a ceremonial fashion as though to suggest, may this never change. May this city be desolate for all eternity and in perpetuity. But I think probably it has to do with salt in the fields with salt. That was done in ancient times to really rub salt into the wound of a defeated foe, as we might say. And when all the men of the tower of Shechem heard that, they entered into the hold of the house of the god Berith. Now, in most ancient cities, there was a tower, a strong tower. You remember how David said in Psalm 18, God is my strong tower? Most cities had walls around them in the first place, but if the battle went against them and the walls were breached, there was usually a strong tower, which was a last refuge. When everything else had failed and they were losing desperately, the last refuge was to flee to a tower and shut the door and just kind of hope to wait it out somehow. Of course, once you're in the tower, what can you do? You're surrounded by the enemy. You're just kind of stalling for time, in a sense. But that, nonetheless, people preferred to live longer in a tower than to be killed immediately. So the people went to this stronghold, probably to the tower of Shechem. And it says, and it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. And Abimelech got up to the mountain Zalmon and all the people that were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bough from the trees and took it and laid it on his shoulder and said to those who were with him, Take ye what ye have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done. So every one of them got a branch to build a fire by the tower. And all the people likewise cut down every man his bough and followed Abimelech and put them to the hold, that is up next to the tower, and set the hold on fire upon them, so that all the men of the tower of Shechem died also, but 1,000 men and women. I'm sorry, about 1,000 men and women. Then went Abimelech to Thebes and encamped against Thebes and took it. I guess he just wasn't satisfied to wipe out one city. He was gone crazy, bloodthirsty as he was. I mean, anyone who can murder his own 70 brothers in cold blood, unprovoked, it's not surprising that once he's on the warpath that he'd just go and butcher innocent people. and wipe out cities that hadn't provoked him. And he went to Thebes and camped against Thebes and took it. And there was a strong tower within the city. And to there fled all the men and women and all they of the city, and shut it to them, and gat them up to the top of the tower. And Abimelech came unto the tower and fought against it, and went hard unto the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman cast a piece of a millstone upon Abimelech's head, and all to break his skull. She was a pretty good aim, because it hit him, and it did hit his head, and broke his skull. And as he was dying, as he knew, he called hastily to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw thy sword and slay me, that men say not of me, a woman slew him." He didn't want the indignity of being slain by a woman, though that was in fact the case. And so he wanted to make sure that he was really finished off by a man, so that technically he was killed by a man, even though a woman should have gotten the credit for that. He didn't want that to happen. And his young man thrust him through, and he died. So, bloody man comes to a bloody end. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his place. Thus God rendered the wickedness of Abimelech, which he did unto his father, in slaying his 70 brethren. And all the evil of the men of Shechem did God render to their heads. They all got burned up. And upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. That is, the fable of the trees came true. Fire came out from the bramble and consumed the cedars of Lebanon. Okay, now chapter 10, I don't have much that I need to say about it. We've just about run out of time. I should say this mainly, that there were two judges quickly mentioned. In the beginning, one named Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo, who was a man of Issachar. And he judged Israel for 23 years. And then there arose after him Jair, the Gileadite, and he judged for 22 years. Now, there's no mention of any oppressions or any attacks from the outsiders. So it would appear that even when there were no oppressions, if the people were right with God and God didn't need to bring oppressions upon them, yet God would raise up judges, so that judges were the normal leadership that God intended. If the people departed from God, he'd send oppressors, and then he'd send a judge to deliver them when they repented. But here they apparently had 45 years of peace without any attack against them at this point. And then it says in verse 6, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and served Balaam and Ashtaroth and the gods of Syria and the gods of Zidon and the gods of Moab and the gods of the children of Ammon and the gods of the Philistines. They certainly couldn't get enough gods. And they forsook the Lord and served him not. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them in the hand of the Philistines. Okay, well, this sets the stage, of course, for the story of Samson, because Samson was the one that was raised up to deliver them from the Philistines. In the hands of the children of Ammon. And that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel 18 years, all the children of Israel who were on the other side of Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is Gilead. Moreover, the children of Ammon passed over Jordan to fight also against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was sore distressed. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and also served Balaam." And the Lord said unto the children of Israel, "Did not I deliver you from Egyptians and from the Amorites and the children of Ammon and the Philistines and from the Philistines, the Zidonians also and the Amalekites and the Maonites did oppress you? And ye cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Yet ye have forsaken me and served other gods. Wherefore I will deliver you no more." Now, that doesn't mean that under no conditions he would deliver them again, because obviously he did deliver them again. What he means is, I've delivered you enough, and I really don't owe you anything else. But when he says, "I'll deliver you no more," of course, like everything else he says, whenever he's pronouncing a threat or a promise on anyone, it's conditional. He's essentially saying, if you don't repent, I won't deliver you anymore. God is so merciful that even though you can see God's frustration with them, if we could use that word of God at this point, he's angry at them, and he says, "I'm not going to do it anymore." Yet there's a hidden exception clause, unless you repent. If you repent, then I've got such a big heart I can't help myself but to deliver you again. And so it says, "Go and cry to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you from the time of your tribulation." And the children of Israel said to the Lord, We have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. Deliver us only, we pray thee, this day. And they put away the strange gods from among them and served the Lord. And his soul, God's soul, was grieved for the misery of Israel. He couldn't stand to see them afflicted like that when they were doing their best to repent at this point and putting away the gods. Then the children of Ammon were gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled themselves together and encamped in Mizpah. And the people and the princes of Gilead said one to another, "What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon? And he shall be head over the inhabitants of Gilead." We have Jephthah's story next, and then Samson's. We will take those tomorrow morning. That is, six more chapters? Five more chapters? 11 through 16. I guess that's six more chapters. So be sure you've read those chapters by tomorrow morning, and we will attempt to take the story of Jephthah and Samson tomorrow. Both are significant stories. We'll just do what we can. We'll trust the Lord to get us through it, because we do need to finish this up this week. Okay, and as far as the book of Ruth is concerned, we're going to have the book of Ruth sometime next week. But it's only a one-session book. It's only four short chapters, and so we'll take it in one session. Okay, so you're dismissed. If there's any questions, I can stay around a few minutes.